lights are on, so turn it off.
Summer.
That's it. All right. Good morning, everybody. This is the Tuesday, August 14th work session of the Portland City Council. Commissioner Fish, did you want to start off?
Thank you, Mayor. I have a few opening comments, and then I'm going to turn it over to our distinguished panel. Colleagues, in August of last year, the Portland City Council directed the Portland Water Bureau to plan, design, and construct a filtration plant to meet current state and federal regulations and to plan for the future demands of our water system. To begin this work, I asked the Bureau to address four key questions. What is the proper procurement method? Where is the preferred treatment plant location? What is the optimal treatment plant capacity? And what is the best treatment plant technology? Today, the Bureau will share its findings, including preferred options for each of these questions. I am thankful we're having this work session today as one of my last actions as Commissioner in charge of the Water Bureau. Ultimately, the decision that we'll be making on filtration will be Commissioner Fritz's to make and then to make recommendations to the Council for further action. Today's presentation will be led by senior Portland Water Bureau staff, Mike Stewart, our director, Gabe Salmer, deputy director, Teresa Elliott, chief engineer, and Dave Peters, principal engineer. And I'll turn it over to Mike.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor, commissioners.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking time today to listen to our report on the filtration process. Commissioner Fish already introduced the staff. I think the Water Bureau is blessed with exceptional staff, and the crew we have working on this, I think, is outstanding. Since the council decision 2 August of last year, almost a little bit more than a year ago, we have been extremely busy. We have to have the treatment plant up and operational by September of 2027. That sounds like a long time, but in our world, the world of design and construction, it is not a long time. Gabe, Teresa, and Dave, working with our commissioner's office, have assembled a great team to work on this project, and they'll talk about that team. We have done extensive outreach around our community and with various partners, and Gabe will talk about the whos and hows of that. We have to answer four questions leading to a preferred alternative. That's essential because in the next step of this, we have to issue design instructions for an RFP and actually tell the contractors what it is we want and where we want it within some broad outline. As you'll see, I think they've done a great job. To get us this far, there are a great many people to thank. Literally hundreds of residents have participated in surveys, social media, and in some cases, long interviews. We have talked with our wholesale customers, various large institutional customers, public health agencies and interest groups, and our friends at OHA and the Environmental Protection Agency. PUB and CUB have participated in this process. We have exceptionally good contractors, we think, working on this process. We've had our entire Bureau management team deeply involved in how this thing is going to be set up and how it will work. And certainly, last but not least, Todd Lofgren, Sonia Szymanski, and Commissioner Fish have been involved every step of the way. So without further ado, I will turn this over to our Deputy Gabe.
Thanks, Mike. And I'll go through the PowerPoint slides. Please stop me if you have questions. We can have more of a conversation about this. And we also have some more information for you. If you'd like more in-depth information on the outreach that we did, we'd be happy to provide that to you or your staff. So I'll just start with kind of a background. And we'll go through a little bit of a timeline review, not all the way back, but just to 2017. And you'll remember that in January through March, we found, after a long absence of not detecting Cryptosporidium oocysts. We found 19 oocysts. That put us over the threshold for our once in the country variants that we had. In May, we got notification that that variance would go away, and in August, just a little over a year ago, as Mike said, there was a unanimous decision by this council to select filtration as the treatment option. In December, we received interim conditions and a bilateral compliance agreement that we negotiated with OHA, and that brings us to this year. So on the next slide, you have two timelines, and we just wanted to include both of these to let you know that although today we're talking about filtration, there is another treatment project that we're doing, and both of these will affect Bull Run source water. So the first arrow you can see on the top is the filtration timeline. You can see, I think the main takeaway here is that we are very early on in this process. It's a 10-year process. We have to be on track because every day, every year matters in this process. But we're really in that pre-planning stage. So we have a long ways to go till September of 2027 when we will be complete. The second arrow below there is our improved corrosion control treatment. We usually say ICCT. And we just wanted to show you again how that is moving through the same process as a pilot, the design, the construction. But that completion with our compliance agreement is April of 2022. So the two are moving in concert. And we'll go forward. Again, just a little reminder on the next slide about the treatment benefits. So, yes, we are complying, and that is a huge reason why we are moving forward with filtration. But as the council considered last year, there are also a number of benefits that we get from the filtration process, both removing organisms from the water, but also the amount of chlorine that we may need for disinfection, and then, as a result, the disinfection byproducts. We're also looking at filtration. It will improve the availability of Bull Run water. It won't make more water. We want to be clear about that, but it will allow us access more of the year during different conditions. And the consistency of the water, which, of course, is important to all of our customers, but also to a lot of our high volume and our customers who use this water for chip manufacture and that kind of thing need that consistent quality. And it's a future investment. And as the mayor said last year, we are looking at a longer time horizon than with any other treatment option. So that's what brought us to the filtration option. And now I just wanted to go through a little bit of what we've been doing through the last year. We'll talk a little bit about outreach and engagement. That was a huge focus for us in the lead up to this process, and the team and the tools that we've assembled to help us on this journey. And then Dave will talk a little bit about the four alternatives that the commissioner mentioned. So on the next slide, you can see the number of public conversations that we've had. And I thought that this was an interesting way to show how we've started this process. So almost 1,700 customers have taken our online survey, which is up on our website now. And those customers come from all walks of life and all over Portland, and we'll go through a little bit of that. And as I said, there's some more information about that in your packets if you have more questions about that.
Gabe, just tell folks watching at home, how would they find that survey that they could take online?
On our website?
Yes. What's the website? How would they get there?
It's our link.
There's a link on
that. It's off of our main page on our website. Under
so they would go to PortlandOnline.com and then the Water Bureau?
PortlandOregon.com.
I'm so old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
/ water, and then they can find it from the main page.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
That is a great plug. Thank you. Obviously, we are cognizant of the digital divide, and so we didn't want to do all of our outreach over social media, but it is a wonderful tool that we have to reach people through all of those different channels and platforms. And then we also wanted to just sit with people and understand from our stakeholders what they want out of this process, both how they want to be informed and involved throughout the process and what they want to see and what the values are that should inform us as we work through this very large undertaking. So we talked with our wholesale customers, business and institutional customers, obviously a range of residential customers and public health groups, and a lot of organizations that represent people that we don't always hear from and who don't always have a seat at the table. It was important to us to include a variety of voices. And I will just talk a little bit about the survey on the next slide, just to give you a sense of this. So almost 1,700 customers, 97% are customers of the Portland Water Bureau. You might ask, well, why is someone taking a survey if they are not a customer? 2% more on that list are people who drink the water but are not a customer. You can imagine that's probably someone who works in the Portland area or has access to our water but is not a customer. 34 different zip codes are represented, so this was a fair diversity of on the geographic side. And we were really excited to get, it doesn't seem like a high number, but to get 12% engagement from people who are living in multifamily residences was important to us, again, to get that diversity. We talk a lot to our customers who pay a bill. We're trying to do more outreach to people who don't get that direct connection. And then this was a little bit of a surprise, a happy surprise. 70% of the people who took the survey reported that they have lived in Portland for more than 10 years. So these are people with some knowledge of the system and some investment in Portland. So we were happy to see that. What came out of all of that feedback, both the survey and our conversations, first one, no surprise that customers love Bull Run water. We probably didn't need a survey to know that, but it was a great theme that came out of the process. And that customers generally understand the need for the project. There were very few people that said that they had any concerns as to why we are following this. So that tells us that people know what the rationale is. And that the top-of-mind issues are really water quality, which makes sense, and cost-benefit. And that was interesting because it wasn't just cost. It wasn't just how is this going to affect my individual bill, although we certainly heard that. But what is the value that I'm going to get? What am I paying and what am I getting? So that really, you'll see, influenced us as we went through our process. And what we wanted is to derive those public values to drive the development of this project. And those values that we pulled from the stakeholder process, really that cost benefit, that value, and the impact to individual bills, both are important. We heard from people that, and we share the value that appropriate treatment and chemicals is important for this project to succeed with minimal environmental impacts. That's something that we should be considering as we make these decisions and go through the process. Make sure that we don't just build for the short term. I think that's what that future needs, is how do we build flexibly so that we can make sure that this will work into the future. And a part of that is to make it reliable and resilient as we are over our entire system, and to provide that consistent, high-quality water. So then I'll talk just a little bit about the team that we've assembled and the tools that we're using in this process so far. It's a cross-functional team, so it includes the Office of the Director as well as a number of our employees from engineering, operations. Communications is very important, as we have said, that the outreach and the feedback from the community is key to the success of this project. And resource protection. We know that by implementing filtration, we still have to take care and be the stewards of our source water, and that's very important to us. And then we had consultant support to this point from engineering firms and on the public engagement side that has allowed us to get to this point. So really, as we were making, as we were going through this analysis process, we wanted to be driven by two things. One is expertise, and really brought together very high-level people to make these this analysis process, and also to be driven by the values that you saw that came out of the public engagement process. And that led us to these alternatives that you heard the commissioner and Mike go through, these four key areas that we need to narrow down and get to a preferred alternative in order to define the project and lay that foundation for the project definition. This, I thought, was a great graphic on the next slide that just explains kind of that values framework. So in making, in evaluating these four areas, what is driving us? So you can see everything from public health and water quality, obviously a key one, that cost benefit. How do things integrate with our existing system? That goes into cost. Obviously, if it can integrate more easily, that's going to be a lower cost. But it's a value in its own right. And that implementation, very importantly, has to meet our schedule. We've got 10 years, now 9 years. That clock is ticking, so it has to meet the schedule with environmental impacts considered at every step of the way. And then, again, that future needs, making sure that we are building this for the next generation, which flows into the reliability and resilience piece, because we need this to work, with this project to work, and make sure that those customer interests are provided for. So that was, those are really the values that went into every step of this framework. But we didn't want to forget the expertise that we had at our fingertips. So I won't read all of these, but you know, everything from geotechnical evaluations to make sure that the sites that we were looking at would support what we want to put there, to comparative cost estimates to make sure that we were bringing the best value to the project. There was a lot of work that went into that. So that's really about the process that we have created over the last year that will support us moving forward. But of course, that all that process went into analyzing these four areas and coming up with a preferred alternative. And I will turn it over to Dave to go through those four.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and Commissioners. I'm David Peters, Principal Engineer with the Water Bureau, and I have the opportunity to walk you through the alternatives that we evaluated for these four key areas to get to our preferred alternatives. I have a standard format that I'll kind of run through that will talk about the alternatives we evaluated in each area, the factors we took into account in our evaluation, and some public insights that we used in that evaluation, and then an overview of the alternative, or preferred alternative. So in regards to the procurement methods, we compared alternative procurement methods with our traditional design bid build, or a low bid method. And so we looked at three alternative methods: construction manager, general contractor, which we know as CMGC, design build, and a progressive design build. And in all of these alternatives, we've made the commitment that we will continue to meet or exceed the city's disadvantaged minority women-owned ESB participation goals. And also, this project will have a community benefits agreement as part of the construction. So those are commitments we've made up front in meeting our equity goals going forward.
What does progressive design build mean?
So progressive design build is different from design build in that it's a combination of CMGC and design build. So you have one contract, but you have a PTE contract first to
PTE.
Work out, professional technical expert, to work out details of the design, and then you get a guaranteed maximum price later in the process. So a design build, you'd get a fixed price right at the beginning for the design and the construction of it. Progressive, you get that guaranteed maximum price after part of the design's done.
Thank you.
So for the procurement method, our preferred alternative would be CMGC. And that CMGC has several benefits, and it has the ability for us to drive innovation with the consultants and the contractors. It gives us better ability to control costs and schedules going forward. It allows us to work with the consultants and the contractors to really engage small firms and the minority firms in order to achieve our equity participation. And these contracts create a collaborative working environment where the Water Bureau is able to have control in the decision-making going through the process. And in this particular case with CMGC, the Water Bureau has a lot of experience on several projects that we'll be able to draw upon for this project. So in treatment plant capacity, this graphic has a lot of information on it, and so I'll do my best to explain what's here. But we evaluated five alternatives for capacity. Two of them are not shown on this graphic, and those are kind of the min and max of the range that we would consider. The maximum is 200 million gallons a day, or I'll refer to that as MGD from here on out, is the current capacity of our existing conduits coming from the Bull Run. The lower end of our boundary that we evaluated is 100 MGD, which is about an average day in the city of Portland throughout the course of the full year. But to get to 100 MGD during the summer, we're over that average day and would have to run groundwater a lot more than we do today. So we narrowed the range down, and three alternatives that we move forward in our evaluation are 160 MGD, 145 MGD, and 115 MGD. And those are the lines, the horizontal lines going across the page. And they're superimposed on an orange and a blue line that are our demands in the future. So this is what our demand pattern, or what we expect our demand pattern to look like as we move into the future. The blue line is a normal year, and the orange or red line is what we call a stress year. So we can anticipate that when we have a dry year, that demands can be higher. The dotted line down the middle of the graph is 2027, which is when our plant will be coming online. And so you'll see a steep drop in each of these demand curves, and that indicates when we anticipate one of our large wholesalers coming off our system, because they're currently building their own facilities. So we took all that information. That graph was created by looking at our demands in the past and present. We worked with our wholesale customers and looked at their water system plans to take growth projections in their systems, and pull all that together to develop these future projections of anticipated demands. We evaluated comparative costs for treatment plant capacity. We looked at how groundwater use might affect our choice in the size of our facility. And we also looked at alternative management strategies, and that considers things like how do we use our storage during the summer to get through some of our peak days. If we didn't have enough treatment capacity, how could we use storage in our system to manage for that? So we took all that information into account in our evaluation. And we also heard from the public that when it comes to treatment plant capacity, that they want us planning for future growth, but don't overbuild for it. They recognize that we can phase it, build for what we need today with the ability to expand in the future. And then there's also the ability to meet future regulatory requirements. So the capacity will impact our ability to have some flexibility as we move forward into the future. So some of the key factors when we got to choosing the preferred capacity is that if a capacity larger than 160 MGD is not consistent with our future demand projections. So that would be the maximum that we would do. A capacity smaller than 145 MGD would require increased use of groundwater. So that means we would use it more than we typically do today to meet those future demands, which would come with its own questions about investments in that system to be able to do that. The 160 MGD will meet our peak day demands in the planning period out through 2045 in this case. And we can set facilities of this type up with the ability to expand that capacity later if need be.
How would you do that?
There's multiple ways that that can be done. One would be construction of additional modular basins would be one way to do that. And another way would be to design for a certain flow rate through that system and ask to increase that flow rate in the future.
So are those major overhauls? Are they minor? Give us, you know, if we're sitting here in 2045, what are we looking at here in terms of the scope of what would be required to increase the capacity?
2045 is a long ways away.
I used to think so.
I know. It is a long ways away. One of the things that all water utilities have experienced in the last 20 years is our public and our codes have consistently reduced water use. It's flat. So we don't expect any huge increase at all. It would kind of depend upon what happened in Portland. The city of Portland right now is fairly well built out. I think the numbers that we picked would carry us through 2045. What could happen then, it would be a substantial investment depending upon how much you had to add. But from a technical point of view, it's pretty easy to do. I would not want to overbuild a plant right now. So I think we have a solid number, and there's a technical way to deal with it, and it's very difficult to predict that far out.
As far as additional pools or whatever you describe them as, we're not geographically constrained there, are we?
No, we have 90 acres there.
Oh, that's great.
It takes about 35 acres to actually build what I'm imagining this thing will be. And we're also hoping to work out some energy conservation things like solar field to make it more energy neutral. But we have plenty of real estate to work with up there.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that.
And key, proper zoning.
He's jumping ahead.
But we're getting slightly ahead of ourselves.
Yes, jumping ahead now.
Sorry.
So just to finish up quickly on the capacity then, our preferred alternative would be is to have a range at this point in time between 145 and 160 MGD. Both the 145 and the 160 alternatives had similar costs and benefits, and the thought is that having a range at this point will allow us to do the further evaluations necessary with the site that's been with the preferred site and the preferred technology to work out the details and come up with one number that will be the final number between that range when we're done. Yeah. Now we'll move to the location for the treatment plant. So this is a topic that's been evaluated for a number of years. We've looked at sites actually for several decades. And the sites listed on this graphic, the six of them listed on this graphic, are the ones that have had the most promising elements for a treatment facility. And so we've taken those sites, which are all the way from our headworks, being right at our headworks facilities in the Bull Run watershed. There's a second one, Larson's Ranch, which is in the watershed also. Roslyn Lake has, we've served water to that facility in the past and has some infrastructure already there. Carpenter Lane is one that the Water Bureau purchased for the specific purpose of storage and treatment. Several decades ago, And then Lusted Hill would be near our existing facilities, and then all the way into town, potentially with Powell Butte. So we took a look at a number of factors for all of these sites. We looked at we did geotechnical evaluations. We've looked at the environmental elements of the sites. We looked at land use and whether it's compatible with building a facility of this type there. We looked for properties we own. We looked at parcel size. One of the key ones is hydraulics. We've been very blessed to have a gravity system, and we'd like to maintain as much of that gravity capacity as we can into the future, because that prevents you from having to pump all the water coming out of the watershed. So there'd be cost benefits moving into the future. And we also just looked at the proximity of these sites to our existing facilities, our existing conduits, to understand how complicated it would be to tie into that system. So the public elements that we heard, they want us to avoid factors that would make the project harder to implement or more expensive to implement. And we also heard that they'd like us to consider the impacts on the site neighbors. So all that was taken into account as we did our evaluations of these alternative locations. So some of the sites were, all but one of the sites were eliminated based on incompatible hydraulics. Some of them just are too high or too low, and we would not be able to maintain any gravity capacity. Some sites had incompatible zoning, which would make it difficult to actually get the plant sited on the site, if at all. There are some that had some poor land conditions, and then others that we don't have ownership to, so we'd have the ability to purchase, concerns about the ability to purchase that could take a good portion of our schedule. So in the end, the property we know as Carpenter Lane, which is 95 acres, we've about a mile and a half south of our existing Lusted Hill treatment facilities, had good hydraulics. It's already owned by the Water Bureau and is zoned appropriately for us to.
Teresa, do you mind going back three or four slides just so we can once again look at that map and orient ourselves with Carpenter Lane?
It's the one right in the middle of the map.
So, okay, thank you.
Okay. So Carpenter Lane would be our preferred alternative. And the 95 acres does give plenty of property for the expansion capabilities. So moving into the treatment plant technology, there are three filtration technologies that are used in North America on facilities that are over 50 million gallons a day in size. Those technologies are what we call membrane filtration, there's slow sand filtration, and then granular media filtration. And I'll walk through each one of those in a little more detail now. But before we do that, in all of these filtration alternatives, the factors we took into account are water quality. What capabilities do they have for the raw water quality that we have, and what is the finished water quality coming out of the facilities? We looked at the hydraulics of these facilities because to maintain that gravity capacity, you want to have good hydraulics. We looked at regulatory requirements. They all are able to meet the requirements of the rule, but some allow us to go beyond just the basic regulatory requirements. We looked at comparative costs, and we also looked at what other utilities have done. What we heard from the public in regards to the technology is that they'd like us to think beyond just cryptosporidium, and I think that choice was done with the decision that was made last year to go with filtration. We aren't choosing a technology that just solved the cryptosporidium. They asked us to balance the benefits with the costs, and then as we develop this system, to have a robust process to explain our choices to the public, to help them understand the benefits that they're receiving for the cost of the facilities. So in regards to membrane filtration, a membrane filter is a physical barrier. It's actually a small tube, looks like a straw, only smaller, that has lots of little tiny holes. And anything larger than the tiny holes in that membrane gets filtered out. If it can't get through, only the water goes through. The larger stuff gets filtered away and taken away. The picture in the lower right is a canister that has hundreds of those little tubes or membranes in it. They're compact. This membrane filter would have the smallest footprint of all the technologies, but it's the most expensive. It has the most equipment, and those membranes have to be replaced on a periodic basis. And it's also expensive from an operating standpoint because you have to be pumping your water all the time to get it through the filters. There's only four facilities in North America that are over 50 million gallons a day in size, and none of those are over 145 million gallons a day. The largest one in North America is up in Canada, is 132 million gallons a day. So they haven't advanced to be a large size yet.
Why? Why is it difficult to have a big one? I mean, why couldn't you just add some more of those tubes?
You can. No one's done it yet.
Thank you.
They are very modular in that regard, but it just comes with more equipment. The slow sand filtration, this is a very simple system. You have sand in a basin, and you run the water through the sand. This is very easy to use and easy to clean. What happens with this slow sand filter is there's a biological layer that forms on the top of the sand, and it's called a smutsdecke. And that's what provides your treatment.
Constitutes smutsdecke.
And so with slow sand filtration, it meets the regulatory requirements, but we've talked a lot about having the ability to be flexible and deal with changing water qualities in the future. This would be the least flexible in being able to achieve that. It would also have the largest footprint, and initial estimates would indicate that we may not have enough property on the chosen site to be able to handle a facility of our size. And there's only one facility over 50 million gallons a day in North America, and it's right at 50 million gallons a day. And a lot of that is related to just the amount of property that you would need to operate a facility of that size. And then in regards to granular media, it's simple also. It's a sand filter. You just run the water through the sand at a much higher rate than you do with the slow sand filtration. So it allows you to have a smaller footprint. And there's a way to keep that sand clean. The 146 of the 157 treatment plants in North America that are larger than 50 million gallons a day use a form of a granular media filtration. Many of those are, about 40% of those are larger than 145 million gallons a day. The largest one is in Chicago and is nearly 1 billion gallons a day treated at that site. This technology would be the most adaptable to any changes in water quality in the future, and it has a moderate footprint and moderate cost. So when it came to the evaluation to get to a preferred technology, this is a high-level overview. There's a lot more that went into this choice. But generally, membranes are high energy use and have high capital and operating costs. Both the energy and the operating costs are related to the pumping required for that system. Slow sand just has significant size, and relative to the other two technologies, it's comparative poor water quality. And then with granular media, it has the best operating capabilities. It provides a good water quality, good stable water quality, and would be the most flexible for managing into the future.
Just one comment there. We presented the same information to the Portland Utility Board, our PUB oversight group, last week, and they had some very good comments on this process, about the process and our analysis. And one of the things they pointed out is that you can see each of these types of filtration within 10 miles of here. Not at the same scale, the same scope that we would be considering, but it's something that our team has gone out and looked at these in the area so that we can really get a sense of why those decisions were made by people who are who have a lot of the same local constraints and issues. So it was a helpful reminder from us and a good reason why we talked to our stakeholders and to our PUB.
So that's the overview of the alternatives to get to our preferred alternatives. And at this point, I'll just take a few slides and go through some of our next steps and our near-term activities. So on the project, there's several moving parts to stay on schedule and get this done in 9 years. One step that we took recently was to submit a letter of interest to the Water Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, commonly known as WIFIA. And that's a federal program that is offering low-interest financing for large water infrastructure projects throughout the U.S. Up to 49% of the project value could be obtained through this program. So we submitted a letter of interest to be considered for that.
Dave, let's acknowledge that a copy of the letter from the delegation to the administrator of the program is tab 6 in the packet that we have. And the idea here is to explore alternative ways of financing a capital construction project of this size. WIFIA could be one of a number of ways that we could ultimately end up financing it. And yes, Mayor, we are working closely and under the supervision of government relations in exploring whether we might be eligible. And then there would have to obviously be a comparison with the kind of existing financing that we have, and would this be a better deal, and some other concerns. But we wanted to at least launch this so that we would have an option to consider when we get to penciling it out.
Great.
Our early next steps to take these preferred alternatives will begin to jump into doing a pilot study of the preferred technology, and that's where we work out the details of the system in terms of evaluating the size and the elements of it and all of that. We take that information from the pilot study and turn that into a project definition, and that's where we lay out the site, we lay out how we'll connect it to our system, we'll go into detail about what the facility will look like going forward. All of that will be done to submit to the state for their approval by November of 2020. And then next year, this year we'll be doing
it. Who at the state needs to make that approval? Is it OHA or who?
Yes. It is OHA, yes.
And is that a technical review or is that simply an outcomes-based review?
They actually do a technical review of the pilot studies to make sure that it meets the requirements of the rule.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So later this year, we'll be doing a request for proposals for a design consultant, and in 2019, leading to a contract with that consultant. And then we'll also be doing a CMGC request for proposals to hire the contractor next year. So this next slide is just
a question about the methodology. So given that, and I'm sorry, I'm obviously no great expert on these kinds of systems, but given that you have to do the pilot study, then you scope it out, then you have to have a technical review at the state level, it feels like by the time you get to the procurement process, you already have a pretty good idea of what it is that you want built, don't you? And doesn't that reduce some of the value of CMGC?
No. The reason we have a pretty good idea of what we'll build is because we've had the input from the designer and the contractor to get to that point.
So at what point do they come on board then? Because the way I read the last slide was it seems like they come on after the pilot, after the scoping, after the pilot, and after the state review. Am I incorrect about that?
Both the designer and the contractor should be on board before we submit to the state in 2020.
Very good. Thank you. Yeah. Are there, I don't have any sense whatsoever of the size of the market of designers or contractors for this kind of a facility. Is that a broad market or is that a very narrow market?
In terms of market design contract, it's basically all the big kids on the block will be interested in this. I expect we'll get very competitive proposals from most of the major contractors.
Very good.
In terms of the construction contractors, there are a lot of construction contractors. While it's a complicated facility and a big facility, the construction is pretty standard. It's concrete and pipes.
Very good. I mean, as you know, one of the downsides to CMGC is the strong temptation to escalate costs up front. And so obviously the more interest there is, the better in that regard. So I'm glad to hear that answer.
I mean, if I might
not add, that I will be micromanaging you.
if I might add to Mike's comment, as we did the RFP for the program management and support contract, we did an informational meeting in December of last year, and we had over 40 consulting firms that attended that meeting. 13 of them were identified as potential prime contractors for that. And we also, at that time, which is early stage, even just for the planning, we even had 3 contractors that attended that meeting, and they were some of the bigger ones around town.
So the problem we're running into in construction generally is escalation with the subs. So does the guaranteed maximum protect us against problems with subcontracting?
Yes, it does, with a couple of exceptions. Everybody reads the news here. We've got tariff problems, and that's affecting today buying steel and so on. We build escalation factors in for that. So we watch fuel, we watch steel, and in a larger sense, it's the fair and equitable thing to do with the contractors.
But once the contract is actually executed, they absorb that risk, don't they?
No, there are escalation clauses in the contract to cover fuel. What happens when your fuel's a really good example. Fuel prices bounce up and down, and the contractor has no control over that. One of the things that you try and do, and particularly in these large contracts, is share risk where it's to your benefit. If a contractor can't predict the risk, what the contractor does is throw money at it, and it jacks your price up. So if you have something in the contract that you can identify and you can clearly outline down the road what the price structure may or may not be, you can reduce the price of your contracts by agreeing to share risk, essentially, with a contractor. And it's pretty well settled in the industry right now that we do fuel. Sometimes people do concrete because it's basically a fuel-driven activity, and certainly in terms of steel. And I think all the city bureaus that are building big things right now are experiencing price increases in steel, and it's partly the market and partly the blasted tariffs.
Definitely steel and subcontractors. So who takes the risk for labor? because I assume you're getting as close to some sort of a cost plus model, and then you agree on what are the variables that nobody controls. But if there's a shortage of labor, who absorbs that cost?
Currently, it's actually the...
Introduce yourself.
I'm Teresa Elliott, Chief Engineer, Portland Water Bureau. Currently, we carry the fuel and the steel and labor as escalation clauses or contingency costs. We put it in an owner's allowance pot, and then if we discover that we're having problems and we need to provide... increase the contract amount to cover those additional costs, we move those from owner allowance into the GMP portion. So in general, the city is the one that it's a shared cost. If it's a CMGC, the contractor is assuming a certain amount, and then we assume the rest and put it in our pot.
If we're taking the risk for materials and for labor, what risk is the contractor taking?
We split that cost.
We split it?
Yes.
So we're sharing that
yes.
risk.
Okay.
And the contractor, they're still liable for the biggest risk, which is performance.
Yeah, that's a good point, Mike. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, so the timeline slide was just another reiteration, again, to show we're still real early in this process, and we have a long ways to go.
Dave, move the mic a little closer to your mouth.
Okay.
There you go.
In regards to the outreach efforts.
And I'm sorry, Mike, just to put a fine bow on that, just so people know what we're talking. You said they're responsible for performance. In other words, they don't get paid at the end until they meet the criteria that we've established. Is that correct?
We review. They get paid throughout the project. They have to submit payment estimates, and we verify that what they planted is what we're paying for.
But at the end, how does that final review, the performance review, take place? What's the final disposition, if you will, of the project?
In some respects, that depends upon what went on. If we have claims and so on, then the final tally can take quite some time.
And that's likely with a project of this complexity, isn't it?
We may have, I wouldn't call them like legal disputes, but we'll wrestle for sure. We haven't had a lot of experience with real feuds with contractors here. By and large, we've gotten good performance, and they've performed well, and we have paid them.
Glad to hear it. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. So in regards to next steps for outreach efforts, in the rest of 2018, we anticipate that we'll continue with our quarterly updates to the pub and CUB. And we, to help with that, we've developed a short-term communications framework that has identified some specific activities for us to meet with those groups and others of our stakeholders that we've already talked with to date. And then for 2019, we'll continue with the quarterly reports, but we'll be in the process throughout this last quarter of actually creating a full communications plan for both the treatment projects that we have shown in our timeline. So the improved corrosion control and the treatment will be part of that communications plan going forward. So next steps in terms of when we return to City Council, we will actually be back to the City Council meeting next week with two ordinances. The first ordinance will be for the program management and support contract, and the second ordinance will be the CMGC findings requesting an authorization to go with the alternative procurement for construction. And then we'll follow that in 2019 with an ordinance for a design consultant and also a report to council on the contractor selection for the CMGC. And in addition to those efforts, we're committed to annually coming back to City Council and providing a report on our progress. So that concludes the formal part of the presentation.
I have a few questions, but Commissioner Frist, you want to go first?
Thank you, and thank you for the presentation. It was a great overview. Thank you, Commissioner Fish, for having the work session and for providing all of this information. So I have a question starting on page 21. If you could put the slide back up of the capacity issue, please. Yeah, that's the one. Thank you. Why the increase in a stress year? And you define what is a stress year, and why the increase in capacity need?
So the blue line is just an average of all the data and the analyses, and then the stress year would look at a year where, like 2015, we had a really dry summer. That's an anomaly when you compare it to averages. And so this is an evaluation to try to account for those types of years that might come up.
What is it that causes more water use in a dry summer?
One of the big deals, 2015 is a great example. Actually, this year is a great example.
This year
is actually a better example, but it's not over yet, it's kind of hard to use the annual data because it's not done. The supply, it sort of depends upon where you start. In a normal year, even what I'll call a normal dry year, which is not this year, in a normal year, our reservoirs start full in May. And this year, they weren't. So you've got less volume of water to peddle. And in normal years, there's usually one or two big rainstorms in the summer. If we have like 4 days of rain, all of our problems are solved. I don't see 4 days of rain in the horizon. So it's not so much use, per se. The use stays fairly stable unless we do something, curtail or something like that. But we don't have the volume that we usually have at the beginning of the summer. And that's what a kind of stress year is. We don't start off with the volume that we normally have.
But this shows the peak of day demand in gallons per day rather than what we've got left in the reservoir.
Commissioner, I think you were talking about what drives that demand. And as we've seen this year and in 2015, we look at those hot days when people are using more water. That could be for irrigation. A lot of our water is used on those outside on watering property, both on the residential and commercial side. Is that what you're getting?
Yeah, because I'm actually been surprised that we haven't had a hose pipe ban this summer. My garden is happy about that, but you know, I will be interested in getting more information about what's commercial use that's going to be necessary to irrigate the crops, etc., versus potentially optional use of whether or not my flowers die.
Right. Right. And we work a lot with our the Regional Water Providers Consortium to make sure that in this Portland has one media market, so that information, even though water sources are different within the Portland area, people are getting their information, you know, from the same groups of media. And so we work carefully together to craft what does your garden need for this week? So what does an inch of water look like? All of that information so people can make wise choices about their water use.
Yeah, because obviously one of the key questions is how much water are we going to treat? So I think that's really interesting. And also noticing that from 2018 to 2024, the line goes almost steady but down a bit. And that's what we've been seeing, isn't it, that people are conserving more, choosing not to water their flowers except when absolutely necessary, et cetera. And so I'm wondering then, I appreciate you explaining about the drop with Tualatin Valley getting their own water supply. Why is the line continuing to drop a little until 2033-ish and then going up after that?
So this is built on projection. So no one knows exactly what that will look like, but it's built on past demand and what we think in the future. A lot of Portland has been very fortunate that we've built more densely more recently, and so that dense building pattern uses less water than a sprawl type of pattern, and so we don't have that same pressure on demand. We also have a number of more efficient washers and items and utilities that use water have become more efficient. I think that we'll start to we've seen the benefit of that over the past decade and so. At some point, you can't get more efficient than we